Hello everyone, I think we'll get started because we're over the time. So the title for today's talk was Whole of Wealth in Retirement. The session is really, we spend a lot of time talking about superannuation and personal expenditures, and the idea with this session was to build it out a lot more and particularly talk about one of the biggest sort of costs in retirement, which is aged care, health, that type of thing, particularly aged care. We originally had two speakers, but unfortunately Brendan Burwood, who's going to be speaking from the point of view of financial planning, what do people need in retirement, what do people have, you know, when they take into account the whole of wealth, he had to pull out at the last minute for a funeral, unfortunately. So we're going to focus the session a lot more now on aged care because we have Ian Yates here, who I think is probably one of the leading people in Australia to talk about aged care. Ian Yates is Chief Executive of COTA Australia, which is the national peak body for the state COTAs, Council of the Ageing. And he's been involved for years in a whole variety of federal government and aged care sector national bodies, including Aged Care Financing Authority, the Aged Care Quality Advisory Council. He's been involved in a lot of policy work with government, particularly leading up to some of the changes that were made in this budget. Ian is also a member of the ASIC Consumer Advisory Panel, the Advisory Board at the Centre of Excellence in Population Ageing Research, CEPAR, and a whole host of other roles. What I think will be really useful today is because there's so very poor understanding across the community and even amongst us about what is the burden of aged care and how does that get met and what can we do from the policy point of view to help people, will be for Ian to speak on it. And I think given that we've lost one speaker, Ian's happy just to expand a bit and talk a little bit more about the things he, you know, covers and the policy work that he does, and then we'll take questions. And if we end the session early, we just end it early. So feel free to ask whatever questions because we've got a relatively small group and there'll be time. I'm Catherine Nance from PricewaterhouseCoopers. I should have said it at the start, so anyway. Ian, welcome.
Thanks, Catherine, and thank you to those of you who've shown some interest in this. It's been a battle over recent years that we've engaged in, and I've engaged in particular, to try to get people involved in thinking about retirement and retirement incomes, not just super, obviously, but the whole gamut of retirement incomes, to think about aged care. Because when I look at some of the suggested budgets for people in retirement at all sorts of different levels, I notice that things like aged care seem to play a relatively little role. And yet, as I'm going to try and demonstrate today, they are quite critical. So what I'm going to do is talk for a little while about what aged care is as a system, not the caring bit, but the system of aged care. What the costs are, what the challenges are, and some of the ways forward. And I'm going to do some updating as I do that about initiatives that were in the federal budget less than 2 weeks ago. Feels like a long time ago, but less than 2 weeks ago. This was indeed a budget with which we worked closely with government for many months, that focused on the ageing of Australia more than any other budget has for a very long time, if not ever. So in the broad, basically, perhaps I should have said, if I asked you what aged care is, what would you say? And most people in Australia say nursing home, old folks home, or somewhere I don't want to go. There are actually three different principal programs in aged care. The first is a program called Commonwealth Home Support Program, or CHSP for short. Commonwealth Home Support Program, you might, if you've known anything about this sector, have known in the past as the Home and Community Care Program, or commonly called HAC, which was a Commonwealth state-funded and state-administered program. And it provides a whole range of services from things like gardening and house cleaning and personal care, social support, and so on, including some group activities, usually of a lower key or lower intensity nature. There are close to 1 million people, 960 something 1,000 people, it was a 216 figure, I think, who receive some support out of Commonwealth Home Support. Programs like Meals on Wheels, funding falls within Commonwealth Home Support. Then there's a program which is, in the scheme of things, relatively new, but I put it in this order because it's the order really of intensity. Home care packages. 20 years ago now, some people started to say, I wonder if we could provide some level of support at home that would keep people out of residential care for longer. And that started what became a community aged care packages program. That's expanded now to a program that has four levels of package. And there are of intensity ranging from about $8,000 a year to close to $50,000 a year. And there are 87,000 places and 95,000 people relates to the 87,000. I thought I'd switch that, but I'm not sure which version we've got here. So the 87,000 places which on an annual basis meet the needs of 95,000 people in that. But that is rising to 151,000 places in 2021. So you can see it almost is doubling. And that is in part what was in train, but is also an outcome of the federal budget, where there was a significant increase in particularly the high-level packages that are available, which of course cost more. And then there's residential care, which are commonly called nursing homes, and there are about 200,000 places around the country of residential care. On an annual basis, about 230,000 people take that. So you can see, when we talk about aged care as a whole lot of it is the lower level care, and increasingly, and by 2021, the high-level care at home is approaching the scale of the residential aged care program. There are a whole lot of other smaller programs, including respite care, both in residential care and respite care in your own home. Transition care, which is about when you come out of hospital, making sure they don't just shove you into the nearest nursing home, but actually rehabilitate you and make sure that if at all possible you can go home. I can assure you, by and large in hospital, their principal objective is to get you out of that bed, and they have, state ministers have the cute term of bed blockers for older people who hang around in hospital too long. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander flexible care program, multi-purpose services which are in regional and rural areas and have a mix of programs, dementia support, advocacy, there's a range of different smaller programs. So how do you get into aged care? Well, there's a thing called My Aged Care, which is the gateway now to aged care. It's a website, it's a call centre, and from those you can get information, advice and referral. To get into aged care, you need to either go through an aged care assessment team to assess your eligibility for residential care or home care packages, or a regional assessment service for Commonwealth Home Support. Why are there two different assessment services? Well, the answer is because of history between Commonwealth and the states, as is the answer to many irrational things in Australian society. The Commonwealth in the last budget has reaffirmed its commitment to combine these two into one single regional assessment service. So there will just be an assessment service that you go to essentially say, do you meet the criteria in terms of frailty, physical need, the kind of help you need to be supported or to access residential care? But there's also an assessment undertaken by Centrelink which assesses either your means, that is a small proportion of most people's house wealth and other means and their income, if for residential care or home care packages, or your income. Now, if you are eligible for Commonwealth Home Support, you'll get referred to possible providers of basic services. In home care packages, since February last year, you get assigned the package. So it doesn't get sent to any provider, you get it, and you choose your provider. And for some reason, we do have the earlier version, that of your, it shouldn't be there. So there'll be some other changes as we go through. And in residential aged care facilities, you get you don't get referred to possible providers. You actually can choose providers off of My Aged Care or other websites or brokerage services or what your neighbour told you. Assessment services regulate eligibility. This is aged care and how is it regulated? Assessment services regulate your eligibility in terms of your health. There's a body called the Aged Care Quality Agency, which accredits residential services through accreditation and reaccreditation audits against the set of standards. And it conducts annual unannounced visits. There's an Aged Care Complaints Commissioner who is independent and receives and resolves complaints from consumers and staff and refers issues to the quality agency or the department. And then the department, which acts on issues referred by the quality agency if they're not resolved or the complaints commissioner, and decides sanctions, which can be stopping you being able to bring in new residents or imposing clinical controls or can close you down. And every year a number of providers are closed down. So the single quality and safety agency, aged care, how is it changing? I forget to read the headings. Those agencies I just talked about, the quality agency, the complaints commissioner, and a section of the department that deals with this stuff. In January 2019, next January, the quality agency and the complaints commissioner will be combined into a single quality and safety agency. And from 1 January 2020, the departmental functions of sanctions, etc., will be in that agency. So there will be one place that regulates providers. And there's a new set of standards that will cover home care as well as residential care. In the budget, there was an in-principle decision to place residential care funding in the hands of the consumers as well as home care packages, subject to an impact study to be conducted this year to work out whether there are things that would have to be done to ensure that the transition worked smoothly and didn't end up with too many poor providers going broke at once. The budget's also provided for a number of pilots of consumer support services, which will provide face-to-face support to people trying to access and navigate aged care. And the budget also had a very large increase in home care packages, although there's a bit of political footballing going on about that, that makes home care packages comparable with residential care. In other words, it's becoming the new norm. There's a whole lot of other measures which, if you were just an aged care audience, I'd talk about, but those things are all happening. Those are important things. So what does it cost? Well, Commonwealth Home Support, the base level, varies between the states because it's a history of being state-run. So in Western Australia, there's a whole schedule of fees that you pay for services. But in Queensland, and this goes back to their tradition of free hospitals, you virtually didn't pay for any services. And notwithstanding that it's been a Commonwealth program for some years, individual providers out there do as they would like to do, and so some of them charge fees and some of them don't. That's supposed to change and be common around Australia, but we are in a certain point in the electoral cycle and government's appetite for doing things about fees is not great. In home care packages, which range in terms of government contribution from $8,000 a year to over $49,000, there's a maximum basic fee of 17.5% of the pension, or about $23 a day. That's the same across all four levels of packages. Reviews have said it should be made proportionate and it should be better income tested so that there can be more of those packages. That also hasn't happened, even though what it does is force people to stay on the lower level packages in CHSP because they don't want to pay the basic fee for a low level package. In residential care, people firstly pay an accommodation charge unless they have no assets or assets less worth than $47,000, or if they do own a home, if it's being lived in by a protected person, which is predominantly a spouse, that could be, for example, a child who has been caring for you for some years and relies on the house. So if you're a supported person, the government will pay the provider $51 a day. Otherwise, you pay an accommodation charge. On average, people are paying between $250,000 and $380,000 for what's called a refundable accommodation deposit, a bond, which is fully refundable. Although I can say that in places like Sydney, it is not unusual to have bonds well in excess of $1 million. And there are some around the harbour that are in the $2 million range. There is actually up to, at the moment, the sum of $550,000. It's a free market. You can just say this is what we charge or negotiate it. Over $550,000, you need the permission of the Pricing Commissioner, Aged Care Pricing Commissioner, and a recent review has recommended that that be increased to $750,000. The reason for having a cap essentially relates to trying to prevent a practice that was quite widespread in the past, which was, oh, hello, you'd like to come into residential care. How much money have you got? Oh, $1.5 million. Okay, we'll leave you $47,000 and you can give us the rest, and not only can you come in here, but you can get the full age pension as well. And then the pension would be paying for what we call the hotel costs, which is 75% of the pension. And that little racket meant you protected yourself from the assets test. You got all the money back your estate did when you died, and taxpayers paid for these people who were quite well off. So that's why there is a cap on the system that says, yes, there is a real commercial value in this level of bond. Because they were getting $750,000 or $1 million bonds in places that were not related to house prices or anything. So you pay a refundable accommodation deposit, or you alternatively you can pay a daily accommodation payment. And that figure, for the record, is correct, it should be 380. A DAP for a 380k bond would be $60 a day. Or you can pay a mix. And the general way that people have paid for residential aged care is through a RAD. And many people sell the house, pay a RAD and have some money left. But increasingly with people going in for short stays, the use of daily accommodation payments is increasing. Also, you have, in principle, I think I might say this on the next slide, you have 28 days to make that decision, although there are providers who kind of make it clear that if you want to come in here, you have to pay one or the other. And you can change at any point of time. And then hotel costs are 75% of the pension. Care costs, the government pays unless you're means tested, in which case you pay more. So in my revised version, which I thought we had checked that we had the right version, but anyway, this slide should now say, what might it cost? Because the other thing to say in what does it cost, which is not in this slide, is there are annual and lifetime caps, but they relate only to the means tested fee. They don't relate to accommodation at all, and they don't relate to hotel charges and so on. In 2011, the Productivity Commission did a seminal report on aged care that's driven a lot of the reforms, and they recommended higher user charges for all aged care, including inclusion of the principal residence in a single means test. That was also recommended by the David Tune Legislative Review of Aged Care Reform last year, which was ruled out immediately by Cabinet. We're at a certain point in the electoral cycle, and anyway, the home is kind of precious. But it's also been the policy of the National Aged Care Alliance, which is a body of 50-odd organisations across the sector, all the provider peaks, the consumer peaks, the unions and the professional organisations, and we've taken that to several elections. I think what I'm just trying to point, and I could go a lot further, is that irrespective of the position on the family home, higher user charges in one way or another will become a key feature of the future of aged care, higher charges. And why is that? Because if you go and look at the intergenerational review, I'll just come back to that in a minute. If you go and look at the intergenerational review, in terms of percentage of GDP, the only expenditure line in the federal budget that increases faster than aged care in the next few decades is acute care. Aged care increases proportionately, and I think as I read in the Fin Review this morning, there was a presentation today at this conference from Michael Rice indicating that the cost of the pension in GDP terms is actually likely to fall. Aged care is going up rapidly, and both sides of politics go somewhat white when they look at it. So you might ask, and many people have taken this view, why does it matter? Why is it important? It's only a minority of people will need it. And the oft-quoted figure is that only 7% of people over 65 are in residential care at any time. That's true, but it's irrelevant. Entry to aged care, firstly, entry to aged care, residential aged care, is now about 85 years. Take-up of a home care package is rare under the mid-70s. And indeed mostly headed up towards 80 for the higher level ones. But there the actuarial chance from the age of 65 that you would need residential care, and wait for it, is 1 in 2. And I have an actuarial graph I can provide you that shows that. It has a gender differentiation, so women have more chance because they tend to live longer. And while they're living, they tend to look after the partner who then dies and doesn't need the care. And then the woman does need the care. But overall, it's 1 in 2. What happens to the other person? Well, they die. And that only starts to shift by mid-90s when the genetically gifted start to predominate and the numbers drop. So that means that I think it makes it a much more essential thing to plan for, that if you don't die first, you're going to need residential care in 1 in 2 cases. And then, of course, in terms of needing other kinds of home support, it's a very, very high chance that you will need it. If you need high-level care and you prefer to stay at home, you will have to pay a co-contribution. You're increasingly likely to need to pay a means-tested fee. There are long waiting lists, and even though the numbers are growing, there will continue to be significant waiting lists. And the maximum subsidy may not be enough for the care that you want to provide at home. So the chance that you will need aged care other than residential care is very high if you don't die first. If you prefer to stay at home but you don't have a substantial income, how do you pay if you're living in your major asset? The budget made major changes to the pension loan scheme, so that now if you're a full pensioner, part pensioner or self-funded retiree, you can borrow up to 1.5 times the pension from that scheme if you're a part pensioner or self-funded retiree, or 50% more of the pension if you're a full pensioner. That's an interesting decision by government, which back in 2012 declined to take up a Productivity Commission recommendation to establish an equity release scheme so people could pay for their aged care out of it. Will other equity release schemes develop now as a result? And what about planning for it with a SIPA with a deferred component? Which indeed in the budget we now have the first formal measures of encouraging Australians to think about that, both in terms of policy settings around, a SIPA is a comprehensive income product for retirement, usually comprised of a mix of having a lump sum available to you, a pension, allocated pension to live off now, and a deferred annuity later that can turn into an income stream in later life. Another issue is if you do need residential care, how do you know whether a RAD or a DAP would be best? It varies between people's financial circumstances. You need good advice from where. And as I said, providers are supposed to give you 28 days, but that's pretty well a short time to decide. Another issue is that what's in your best interests may not be the view of your dependents or your inheritors as to what is in their best interest. There are lots of complexities around powers of attorney, advance care directives, and other delegation instruments. There's a couple of words missing there. Delegation instruments. It's a complex area, and just ignore the repeated last para. It's a complex area, and indeed it is an area that's increasingly part of elder abuse in our society. And it's also pleasing to see the government putting quite a bit of money in the last year, including additional money in the budget, into promoting greater awareness of and programs to address elder abuse. But that inheritor versus older person dynamic is frequently shows the nasty side of many families, and getting that right is important. So I think that at the moment in the community, aged care needs, the aged care system, and financing aged care are poorly understood. Going into the future with the numbers of people who are growing older than we've ever had before, the numbers of people over the age of 85 triple in the next couple of decades. Apart from what the government provides, your capacity to negotiate what you want will always have a price tag. And I think deferred products may well have a capacity to provide additional resources later in life that can help us to address this. So I'm happy to answer questions, into discussion.
Questions. I'll start. It'd be good if there's some questions from the floor. So just to start with a couple of things. How do people now plan? What planning do people do and how do they do it?
Very few people plan. I would say I've done a lot of work in the last couple of years, and particularly the last 12 months, in the superannuation industry, with financial planners. And the evidence that I have and that they tell me is that very few people raise the issue, either because they don't want to think about it at all, or secondly, because they don't actually understand its complexity. And they accept that there is a kind of general sense in the community that if I have to go into residential care, I can sell the house. My point here is that actually in different scenarios that can be financially the right thing or the wrong thing to do. It has been a behavioural tendency, but it is shifting. It's interesting to see it shifting. So, and until recently, people haven't really known where to go. Now, the development of the My Aged Care website at least gives you a place that you can wander around a website and read the rules and see what's available. But it's also been an industry in which the industry itself has not encouraged greater awareness. One of the really interesting shifts that's happened since February last year, when home care packages started being assigned to the consumer rather than to provider, is that you now have providers advertising themselves. It's out there in the ether, people talk about it, and the advertising is quite different. So some people say, if you want X, Y and Z, come here. Other people say, so you'd like to stay at home. We'll come and talk with you about what you'd like and help you work out. Those are the kind of differences that are starting to emerge. So people don't tend to plan, and frequently, because they don't think ahead, they get caught in having to make significant decisions in a very short period of time. So we've had programs, as I said, like transition care that try and stop that thing that said, oh, mum had a fall, broke a hip, gone to hospital, they've fixed it up, but they want her out of there, and she'll have to go to a nursing home and that's it. In fact, in many cases, people could come home again with support services if they knew about it. One of the reasons that we now have a really big waiting list for home care packages is that people didn't know they existed. And that's becoming much more widely known, that they are large amounts that you can stay at home. But the lack of awareness is a real issue. And part of that then becomes well, I can tell you some terrible stories. So it's not uncommon for older people who have a major acute episode to have some delirium. This can be misdiagnosed as dementia. It has resulted in people going from hospitals to locked dementia wards of residential care, and then when they come out of the delirium, having to prove that they don't have dementia.
Linda.
So you talked about how poorly understood this area is. How much of that do you think is... I mean, it seems to be an area that, compared with other major financial decisions that people can make, there doesn't seem to be an awful lot of uniform regulation around disclosure and those sorts of things. I mean, and I wasn't sure from your presentation there, so I guess this is my question. When you put those prices up, is there any sort of regulation around what can be charged or the maximum that can be charged in this area, and is that starting to change? Because I think it's something that, just from talking to friends who've been through this with their parents, they find it very confusing to just get comparable information.
Sure.
And, there's so many different charging structures.
There's a few different... Yes, because... So, as I said, if for the kind of accommodation component of residential care, it's a free market up to $550,000 at the moment, and then, as I said, you actually have to have it approved. And recommendation is that go up to $750,000. But then it's a matter that the provider will advertise it, maybe, or they might just come and talk to us. And a lot of negotiation happens, so published prices and negotiated prices tend to differ. With regard to the kind of hotel, that's set at 75% of the pension as a maximum, but there aren't any providers who charge less. Providers have a capacity under legislation to offer you extra services above that for extra cost. There's been a bit of to-ing and fro-ing happening, including in the federal court, about what that means. So, for example, one major listed provider decided that it would charge a refurbishment fee on its accommodation. The Commonwealth took the view that that's part of accommodation charges and is regulated, and took them to court, and then the Commonwealth won. But there is supposed to be the provision to charge extra services. And then in terms of the care fees, essentially the Commonwealth pays those according to a funding instrument which assesses level of need. Providers are pushing for more flexibility in regard to those, or the government pays more. And there's a lot of public policy debate to be had there. But the second question you raise is actually transparency and comparability. And in home care, where there isn't regulation of price, so it's not like the NDIS, where the National Disability Insurance Agency is actually setting prices, it's negotiable. And we had an unfortunate practice that was allowed when we introduced the notion of consumer-directed home care packages before they became consumer-owned, that providers were allowed to charge a service fee, a case management fee, which is a service anyway, and what was called an administration fee. And those administration fees have been a lot of controversy in the community because they frequently are somewhere between 40 and 50%, which as an overhead is pretty high. We've opposed those, and we now have agreement with the provider peaks that will be phased out. We're just talking with government and them about how quickly, so that everything is unit priced. We've also said that providers must put onto MyAgeCare their pricing, remembering that government pays most of this. So we are negotiating with them that they do that voluntarily, or government will regulate it, and if government regulates it, it'll probably make it more onerous than it needs to be. But there's been a reluctance in this industry to be transparent, and it's part of the secrecy that's been there for a long time. So we are promoting efforts to have websites that have comparator information, And if we don't get somewhere soon in terms of this proposed agreement about getting transparency, then we will certainly be lobbying government and opposition to make it compulsory. If you're going to operate in the sector with government funding, you must publish your prices.
Quick follow-up question. Do you have a view on which gives people a better outcome, in-home care or institutional care?
Sorry, which?
Which gives people a better outcome? Okay. The in-home services or the institutional services?
The answer to that, not to be saying, is it does depend on your circumstances. Mm-hmm. But you raise a really interesting issue, which is the aversion to residential care can be such that people end up being poorly treated at home because there's not enough support. Doesn't matter how big a package you get, you're not going to get 24/7 support out of it. Mm-hmm. And the stress that puts on family members is also substantial. So it is the case that, clinically speaking, people would be better off in residential care but are trying hard to stay out of it at home. The challenge for residential care is to make itself, in non-clinical senses, more attractive to people. So is it a place where you go and disappear, or does it build connection with community? Does it welcome family and community involvement? Does it actually give you more say in what happens in the place? That's why we have been so strong on putting the funding of residential care in the consumer hands as well, because it gives more bargaining power. It also means that the good and imaginative providers have the license to expand, and the poorer providers will get pressured. And that's where we're headed. So you're seeing some quite remarkable experimental stuff happening in residential care. Small homes, small, more cottagey type environments, much more integrated into community. You'll see some in the media talking at the moment about building childcare centres and residential care on the same campus. A lot of good things come out of that. So that's the kind of shift we need to see. We need to open up the curtains and the doors, make it more visible and more imaginative. This has been an industry that has been tightly regulated in every respect for many decades, and that suppresses innovation, and that's where we've been.
And can I ask a question about the integration between state regulation and federal regulation in two areas? One is, if you think about, say, ILUs, and access to home care, and then maybe transition to residential aged care on the one hand. And then the other area would be relief of the cost of acute hospital care for people with chronic illnesses and so forth, and the ability to transition them to maybe residential aged care or other facilities.
Good questions. One of the phenomena we are seeing since February last year is the much greater utilisation of home care packages within retirement villages, independent living environments, because the person owns the package now, so they can say, I'm living here and I want you to come. You've also seen some pretty savvy retirement village operators set up approved aged care providers not require that they're, but make the offer, we're providing you with the roof over your head, and we can also provide support services. And different people have different views about that. Some want them separate, some really like having them combined. When the Productivity Commission looked at aged care back in 2010-11, it was asked to look at whether retirement villages ought to be regulated at a federal level, and it said no at the time. But as this closer integration happens and media attention comes onto it, as has happened, I think the Commonwealth is going to take an increasing interest in what's happening in those environments, whether it thinks it's going to legislate or whether it's going to work more closely with the states. I don't think it's clear yet. What was the other bit? What we will see, I talked a bit about residential care being more imaginative. I think we will see residential care become much more diverse. So there'll be people in residential care that specialise in palliative care. And we saw a major initiative in the federal budget to boost palliative care services in residential care. We will see some residential care become much more of a step-down post-acute facility. There's some of that at the moment. And all of the your point about the comparative cost advantage is unarguable. I mean, my big argument to the government about increasing the number of high-level home care packages was very simple. Yes, they're expensive, but because they cost up to 50, so say 30 to 50,000 each, depending on three or four. Every person who is in one of those would have otherwise been in residential care, no question. In residential care, you're paying at least 50,000 for the care, and in 40-something percent of cases, you're also paying their accommodation. So you're saving all that accommodation cost. The logic is inexorable, but government is not just about logic. But I think that logic will drive them. The challenge with the... because that's all their own expenditure. The challenge in terms of the acute versus non-acute is that, of course, more than half the acute's a state responsibility, and again, the federal system bedevils us, basically. If I had my preference, you'd have the Commonwealth doing all the funding of acute, the states administering it, but the Commonwealth doing the funding, and then those trade-offs would become much more real. I might say that the current minister, Greg Hunt, federal health minister, is very aware of all those kind of things and very into preventive stuff, but proving it to Treasury is a whole different ballgame.
In a couple of quick questions from me before I'll hand over to you in a minute, but seeing as Brendan's not here to defend financial planners, so how do you feel the quality of advice is in financial planning, or how extensive it is, how good is it, how readily able are people to get good financial advice on this part, aged care?
Unfortunately, it's not widespread. Knowledge among financial planners of aged care is low. I know that from talking to the firms, but also talking to their industry body. You know, a 120-minute webinar does not make understanding aged care. And unfortunately, aged care providers have not assisted in that process because they're in the rather unique position of actually being able to effectively financially advise you in this area without any licence or restriction on whether you pay a RAD or a DAP in particular. And we are working to change that. So that's why we've been talking about it such a lot the last couple of years. There are, of course, all sorts of issues about financial advisers per se, but very few have a good knowledge of aged care. There are some who specialise, and they actually are now advising other financial advisers. So there's a few that you read about in the industry media who are good at it, but we think we need a lot more.
Thank you. First, I've just got to say, Ian, what a fantastic job you've done in this area. You've been like a one-man crusade for years now, and it's tremendous. But you mentioned in your talk about the fact that would the expansion of the pension loan scheme be a catalyst to a greater reverse mortgage market. But I kind of think it might be more intractable than that, because on the supply side, you've got all sorts of issues about cost of funding and uncertainty of length of funding. And on the demand side, we're just not seeing demand. Is it going to take something like Michael Rice's suggestion in the paper today to bring in a means test on the family home to provide the catalyst to create demand, to create supply, or is it just gradually going to evolve over time?
That's a really good question, and I agree with you. And I spent a lot of time in the last few years talking to what there is of an equity release industry in Australia, and there's not much. It's a function of a range of things, so I think that you may well be correct that when government and opposition reach some agreement about means testing in this area and in terms of pension, which is possible, that would facilitate it more. The market in Australia is really tiny. I mean, so the other side of that is if you look at the UK, where the market is much bigger and B, the costs of getting some kind of equity release product and the variety of those products. The cost is less and the variety is greater, but the means testing from government is much harsher. So I think it is going to take that interaction. And this is why we've argued for a long time for a more comprehensive approach to retirement planning that looks at all those intersections and reaches some sort of broad consensus about what to do. We think that government and opposition need to talk to each other behind closed doors for a while and reach some agreement on what they're both prepared to back, and then back it in, presumably within a few months of having an election. I don't think it will just slowly develop. I think it will take some significant shift in policy or some kind of major financial crisis of some sort. And can I say, however, before the 2016 election, we did, as we always do, survey a large number of our members and supporters. So there's quite a cross-section of older Australians. And we didn't release this because we weren't quite sure what to do with it. But we asked the question about essentially the Michael Rice scenario. Do you think that the higher value, part of higher value home should be taken into account in the age pension? And our constituency split 50-50 on it. And since the taper rate on the age pension was changed, that issue gets raised with us all the time. I've got a house that's of, you know, median value, and then I've got these financial assets and I'm not in the pension. And my mate's got a house worth twice as much as me, but less, so we're worth the same. He gets a pension and I don't. That's not fair. And that conversation is happening in a way I've never seen before. So.
Thanks, everyone. So I think we'll have to finish it here. Thanks, Ian, for holding the court. It was a shame that we lost our presenter, but thanks so much for holding the court. And sorry about whatever slip happened, so we got to see an earlier version of your slides.
Thanks. Can I just say, I will, for those who chase these up, I will give them the correct version if people are looking it up.
Thanks. And just a quick answer. Are you a fan of the provider model, like the home care packages and the possibly residential care? Do you think that's a good...
The two together?
Putting it on the consumer.
Oh, yes. Now, we have been a very strong advocate of that, but I might say so has the Productivity Commission.
Okay, great. Thanks, everyone.